Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is your host, Ken D. Foster, for the Voices of Courage show. So many of my audience members are entrepreneurs. You are creatives. You are people that reinvent yourself time and time again. Many of you are developing products and or services to really foster the goodness of humankind, to get things better for all of us, right? So today I thought, okay, why don't I have a guest that can explain to you what is called hypothesis-driven development means and why it's important for you as an entrepreneur or a product manager or product developer. I'm just going to tell you this couple of key issues. This is what caught my attention, and that is this is going to help you reduce the risk of building the wrong product for the wrong market. There's faster learning curves when you understand this. It improves customer-centric design and data-driven decision-making and promotes agility and flexibility. Everything that my entrepreneur friends out there really need. So it's going to be a very interesting conversation. I have an expert as a new book out on this, and we're going to take a deep dive into what hypothesis-driven development is all about. All right, we'll be right back after this break, and then I'll have my guest with me. Well, welcome back, everybody. This is your host, Ken D. Foster. My guest is Alex Cohen. Alex, welcome to the show. It's great to have you today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and Alex says he's got a new book out we're going to talk about in just a minute. But first of all, let me introduce him a little bit to those of you that may not know Alex. Alex is on the faculty of UVA Darden, where he teaches courses on the intersection of AI and digital product. Online, he's delivered over 700,000 courses via, is it Coursera? Coursera. Sorry, I'm not familiar with it. Okay. He's also the author of Hypothesis-Driven Development, A Guide to Smarter Product Management. And before teaching, Alex started and sold 2 companies, and he continues to advise and invest in digital ventures. I love that, because you're not just coming from a hypothesis. You've actually been in the trenches and develop those businesses and know what it takes. So that's awesome. So let's just start where, you know, what interested you to, first of all, get involved in hypothesis driven development? What happened?
Well, around 30 years ago, when I started my first company there, the main thing we had was just resilience and tenacity, and that worked out. Ultimately, it was a sort of a consulting for small and then mid-sized and then larger businesses on their IT. And what I found was we made so many mistakes and created so much waste and unnecessary work for ourselves. And but if you work hard enough, you can get through that. And then as I was at other companies and I started other ventures, I started to learn that I acquired all these other skills. I learned how to code. I learned about design. I learned all the things that I could identify at the time were important to building good digital products. And that certainly helped, but it was still kind of uneven. Some products worked out, some products didn't. And so I really, that's where I came to this idea that, and I certainly didn't get there alone. I mean, this is a very contemporary kind of vein of thinking, but the idea that you need to have that resilience, of course, you know, because otherwise how do you get out of bed in the morning and, you know, do a startup or even work for a startup? But you've also got to treat everything as an experiment, and you've got to kind of tie box it. You got to think about how to minimize waste, and you've got to run a good process. And so what I tell product managers, for example, is it's you should not oblige yourself to always be right, but you should always oblige yourself to minimize waste. In other words, don't go build a big, huge, expensive version of something that's not going to sell. Figure out a way to test that idea before you go off and do all those things.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Okay. So there's a lot of my audience that are, well, okay, what is hypothesis-driven development? You know, what is it? What does it do?
Yeah, well, I would say the central example, if like a lemonade stand, is our little microeconomic vignette that everybody learns in like grade school as they learn about commerce and things. Instead of saying, all right, well next Saturday we'll have a lemonade stand, and that's a business. With hypothesis-driven development, it's not that different. We just say, well, next weekend we're going to set up a lemonade stand on 4th and Main, and we'll run it for 2 hours. And if we make at least $20, we'll call that a success. And we'll say, like, let's do the same thing over again. And if we make less than $20, then maybe we either won't do it again, or we'll push ourselves to do something differently if it's not worth our time to make under $20 going out and selling lemonade.
I like that. Okay. So we start simple, we start small, we see if it works, then we duplicate it, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah. And you'll get into more and more nuance about what's working as you scale and start to service more customers. But the idea is just to do that and treat every single substantial decision as a kind of experiment where in advance you figure out how to define success. And the alternative to this, just because that's mostly what people do in actual practice, is we go off and we do something, and then we puzzle over or we argue over the facts and circumstances and the post hoc, you know, analytics that we have, whatever those are, sales or expenses or customer sentiment. And so the idea is, instead of doing that at the end, frame what's important and what you want to look for at the beginning, and then figure out, you know, that then you already know your decisions are sort of implied after that. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs use the trial and error method, right? They just trial and error until they try to get somewhere. How can your method be more effective rather than just an old trial and error method?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. In essence, it's absolutely a trial and error approach, broadly speaking. And the idea is to expect error, but rather than just trying things and just applying that resilience and that tenacity that good entrepreneurs have, we kind of discipline ourselves, because especially in digital, which is the domain that I mainly operate in, there's no reward for hard work, unfortunately. You know, you can build a great product and release it and then it can just, you know, it can encounter an echoing silence. And that's different than a lot of business. If you make a business, if you go build a house in a certain zip code, or you produce, you know, 100 kilograms of wheat, you'll sell that stuff at some price, you know, maybe a little more or a little less than you hope for. But that's not the case with digital. Lots of things end up just being worth essentially zero, or if they encumber an existing product, less than zero. And so it essentially is just a way to make that trial and error approach a little more intentional and a little more effective by saying, what is this trial exactly? Let's use science, actual science, not just trying things, but trying things under, within whatever practical means are available to you, a specific set of circumstances, independent variables, if you will. And then we know what outcomes we're looking for and what we'll consider a success versus a failure.
Can you give me a concrete example of what we're talking about here?
Yeah. Well, it's a lemonade stand is concrete, but a little, you know, kind of cutesy. Yeah. I work in a company, Jedberg, which builds language learning tools for mainly for the Department of Defense, for professional language learners. And so it's kind of enterprise software alternative to things like Rosetta Stone or Duolingo, where there are these intensive year-long programs where active duty military will go from not knowing Korean at all to being fluent in Korean. That's the intention. That's what they're going to dedicate the next year of their life to. And so we're constantly experimenting with new UXs, and we know we have kind of a North Star. There's this test they're going to take at the end. And so we work backwards from that. That's our proxy for success with the users. And so, for example, we revised a leaderboard. So students within a given cohort can see where they fall on that leaderboard. The idea being, you know, of course, like, well, it's kind of fun, and it introduces this idea of, you know, peer competition, which, you know, is fun, especially if you're just, you know, you're learning language all day. And after we sketched this out and we talked about like how the user would want to engage with this thing, we asked ourselves, well, you know, we put this in the product, how will we know if it's making the users better off or not? And just asking that question, you know, about like, if we do this thing that we sort of intuitively generally think we should do, what are we going to look for in terms of an observable result? Because what we don't want to do is puzzle over that in 2 weeks or 2 months, after this thing's out there. Some people like it, some people don't care about it, and we're like, geez, what should we do? So instead, we pushed ourselves to figure out what proxies for users liking this or it creating the behaviors we want with users we were going to consider a success, which had to do with them visiting leaderboard and their levels of engagement and things that we knew we could observe about their behavior, as you generally can in a digital app. And I really think that added a lot of focus, not only to the way that we went and built the thing and introduced it to the users, but it also made it easy to make a decision about it in 1 to 2 months.
Like that. You know, and one of the things I think you said earlier that I didn't really pick up on, but I want to pick up on it, is the value add to the customer, and you're building that into your model going in. Is that accurate?
Yeah. And the hardest thing to engineer, especially these days with AI, is user behavior. You know, that's what everybody's after. And so with digital products in particular, but really with any product, I mean, it's just, if you're selling tennis balls to a retailer, you just have less access to these behaviors and who these people are. And digital products, you have quite a lot. It just helps you really make use of the things that are easy and the things that are hard in the operating environment for digital stuff.
That makes sense. You know, I'm very curious, like, what digital products that you see kind of coming down the pike pipeline these days that might be really changing, how we interact with our world. How, you know, do you have any of those coming down?
Oh, well, I think that the most interesting thing, at least in my domain and my things I see with my students, are the incorporation of these AI chat experiences into more purpose-oriented user experiences. For example, I teach a coding course at UVA Darden for the MBAs, and we start out using a really simple environment, and they use just regular ChatGPT like anybody would go to. And that works okay, but they're moving stuff around and they're copying and pasting, and then we use this IDE, which is just sort of a local piece of software, integrated development environment that developers use to build software. It's a little more sophisticated. It's not a great thing to introduce to this type of learner at the beginning of the course because there's a lot of things that it does that they won't understand or won't care about yet. And anyway, what they learn with this particular IDE that's very AI forward is how good it is at deciding what context you're looking at to fix your code. And so, for example, the previous set of, you know, what we would now call AI, you know, things like Google's really great at predicting what search results to show a user or what ads to show them. Those things were extremely consolidated and into a few big franchises like Google and Facebook and Amazon, whereas these AI tools create a very long tail of opportunities across industries or franchises. I mean, if you don't have to have a whole big ton of data about your users and the things that they're doing, with just a little bit, you can make enormous improvements to things like, you know, support processes, sales processes. And so I think in my world, going from general purpose ChatGPT to an AI tool like Cursor that really has thought through in a lot more depth when and how the user wants to interact with AI, I think there's going to be dozens of those types of things out there. And that's both an opportunity for people to create new products, you know, as well as a thing to look forward to as we wait for the AI to deliver really great things that help us do our work, whether we're a dentist or a gardener or a retail owner or something.
Well, I like where you're going with that. And I think that, there's so much opportunity. I mean, if you're somebody who wants to redesign doorknobs, you're going to use AI to help you to understand, you know, what we can do digitally, what we can do with shape and form and practicality for the consumer, you know, you're going to be able to have a chip in your eye where you look at the doorknob and it opens. I don't know. There's a lot of innovation that, or maybe it's just glasses you wear and you look over there and the doorknob pops open or it shuts. You know, there's a lot of innovation going to be taking place. I have a question for you you can ponder it while we take a break. It seems like we're all going to have, avatars, AI avatars, whether it be in the classroom with a hologram of Einstein loaded with AI information that Einstein put out in the world, and you ask a question and the holograph answers you. Maybe you'll be like me. I'll be the grandpa that's, you know, is in the corner and they're asking their grandpa, you're asking their dad, you know, he's not there. I'm wondering how long it is until we might be there. And so ponder that. We'll be right back after the break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back, everybody. This is your host, Ken D. Foster. I'm talking with Alan Cohen. And, before he answers my last question, answer the question, and we're going to put up your book and show everybody your new book and talk about that. Go ahead.
Well, I think that in terms of the creating the experience you described, we're there technically. I mean, you can go into OpenAI, which does ChatGPT, has an environment where really anybody can create a custom GPT that has a specific personality. Like, you know, pretend you're Albert Einstein. You can upload public domain works of his, which probably already has access to anyway. And you can, you know, people have people have different takes on historical figures like that, you know, how they would respond. And, you know, you can put that into your instructions and create that experience. I think why don't we have that in the classroom? Why don't all our kids or grandkids have these things right now? Mainly because the people that make these apps and service these industries, whether it's education or fire departments, there's just still, you know, they don't all adopt this stuff right away. It takes time. And I think it's a great question because really it's a good example of where AI is headed. I mean, in the last 3 years or so, these models have gotten more and more powerful every year, and everybody's in awe of how fast those improvements happened. And what seems more likely at this point is that we start to see more of what you described, where they're so good, generally speaking, they could be better for sure, and they will get better. But a lot of the upside, a lot of the gains, the wins out there are going to come from thinking about when and how a given type of user wants to interact with this stuff and how you can present it in a way that's more relevant to them. And for example, presenting a picture of Einstein or, a simulation of him talking and answering questions. And it's a great way to, hypothetically, at least to try out people using AI. Could they go in and ask a question about the solar system and say, answer like you're Albert Einstein and get the same result? Sure. But that doesn't mean that packaging it up and putting it in front of them in a way that's more engaging at that particular time and place isn't going to be a win both for them and commercially for a service that does something like that.
Yeah, I know the technology is already there. I've seen the technology. I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago. There was a group that went into the Oscars, and they were somewhere off the red carpet where they had used an avatar that was, he was like 1920s, I think it was. They took a person that had no video, no nothing, and just they were able to recreate the picture of this guy with him talking or what have you in a holographic experience. So I know the technology is there, and I could see, this being in our classrooms very soon where, if you want to learn about, World War II, you learn it from, Chamberlain, or you learn it from Roosevelt, or you learn it from, different points of view. It's going to be very interesting how that's going to change up our classrooms in so many ways. They may eliminate you,
Yeah, I do. Every time I do something, I get something new done with AI. I get become less and less convinced that my job is one of the irreplaceable ones. Yeah, I think that they will. You have to kind of sort of your job as an educator to make yourself obsolete. So
yeah,
personally, I'm pretty comfortable with that, but. How we'll reinvent our work and the way that the economy factors out is also, of course, a big open question. And how disruptive will it be? I mean, we've had innovations like this, like the cotton gin. People said, nobody's going to have a job anymore. And because that's where we spend so much time just processing this agricultural output. What will we do? And we historically, they're just the economy changes and people focus on different things. And well, hopefully it'll be like that in some fashion on a historical basis. There's every reason to believe it will be. And yet the future is unpredictable. Truth is stranger than fiction because truth doesn't have to abide by, guidelines of what's already happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm an optimist when it comes to that. I see through the eyes of an entrepreneur, and I see that we've got so many opportunities for so many people to really create, much more abundance, much more amazing, convenient products out there and services. I was in India last year. I was in India, and they have a service over there called Blinkit. And we have Amazon over here. Okay. Well, Blinkit in Delhi, it's eight minutes from the time you order to the time it shows up at your doorstep. Okay. Toilet paper, you know, whatever it is. You know, I ordered toilet paper. We also ordered a bunch of other stuff, right? 8 minutes. Amazing, right? I don't know what that's going to happen with robots. Maybe it'll be 2 minutes. I don't know. But, you know, the innovation is here. And here's the thing that I get. I'm putting your book up on the screen. You know, hypothesis-driven development. This is a really important book, I believe, out there, because I think with the coming of a lot more entrepreneurship opportunities comes a different way of thinking. And if I haven't asked you why you wrote the book, but I get that, you know, people, if you think differently, you can create at the level of thought, but you got to have a system in place to be able to do that. And that's what I get with your book. Tell me why you wrote the book, Alex.
Mainly, I did my first book in 2015. I had these Coursera courses that had a lot of enrollment, and I just found that I wanted to have a book version of the things that I was teaching online that had an audience where, you know, I could say, if you read this book and you try some of these things, this is what I primarily have for you, you know, in terms of what I might recommend you do in a given situation. And so the hypothesis was, if, you know, given that there's this interest in the material online in these online courses, then, you know, if I write the book, it'll achieve this certain readership. And it's done that, and I'm really glad that I am able to put it out there. I don't, you know, a lot of people would probably say, oh, hypothesis-driven development, it's not a very catchy title, and it isn't, but, you know, that's not who this book is for. It's not a really an airport, you know, business book. So it's a pretty serious approach to going and putting the discipline in place to actually do this stuff, like you say, because that is ultimately the hardest part. You know, it's not for lack of understanding that I'm not in perfect physical condition. I just, you know, sometimes I want to drink bourbon more than I want to, you know, go for a jog.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what bourbon has to do with going for a jog, but, you know, I get it. But the book is...
It's an alternative. It's a less healthy alternative to going for a jog.
It's a less healthy alternative. And what I get is that with growth, the first step we have to do, I'm going to take the book off the screen, but you can get hypothesis-driven development. Where can they get it, Alan?
On Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Really, anywhere where you buy books.
Yeah, just look up Alex Cowan, okay? Cowan, Cowan, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and you'll be able to get his book. Okay. So what comes first in change is we change the way that we look at things. We change our perspective. We change our beliefs. We change our mind. And that's what a book like yours can help people do. They put it on through your glasses, through your eyes, through your points of view. And now they have a different way of looking at developing what they want to develop. That's what I get.
Yeah. And I think that the easiest way to try it on for size is just to take an idea like, hey, why don't we make the site blue now? And just frame it in those testable terms. Like, you know, if we make the site blue, then, you know, more people will convert to buyers, or more, you know, we'll have more traffic over time, or what. Why do we think it should be blue? What would be a good result? It's also a great way, particularly if you're selling to businesses, to manage your accounts. You know, like when I was running a small enterprise software company with big, huge customers, I never really had the option to specifically say no. I had to work through whatever they wanted. And so this turned out to be a pretty good way. You know, they request a feature. You know, we want this thing to work this way. And I would ask them, like, okay, but, you know, I would never say, like, well, it seems like a terrible idea and very, you know, idiosyncratic to your particular situation. Often it wasn't, but even if it was, a great way to engage with them on that was, well, how will we know if this is working out? What do we want to have work better that we're going to get if we make this change? And that was a better way to engage them on the outcomes they wanted to get in a less kind of arbitrary way.
Yeah, I like that. Well, you know, in the book, you focus on the importance of focusing on the economics of decisions. I really like that. The economics of decisions. You want to elaborate on that a little bit and, you know, how that impacts, you know, product management?
Yeah, a great way to think about it is this. There's this vignette that my friend and sometimes collaborator Laura Klein uses, a job board online for employing your pet. And so this is a, you know, this is a bad idea. And let's just say, because it almost certainly is. And we, so, you know, usually when you learn something, they start with an example that's good. And we're just, we like, you know, ideas that look like they're promising. Jobs for pets is clearly a bad idea. And a great way to think about the economics of decisions in this domain is, how would you give jobs for pets a fair shake? You know, if let's say your boss tells you, like, I had this idea in the shower and this is what I want you to explore this week. But, you know, and then how do we plausibly eliminate the idea with a minimum of waste? And so the you know, if we started the traditional approach, the most expensive way and most wasteful way to test jobs for pets would be to take 3 months and build it and get it working and plan a marketing campaign and spend money on media and find that it doesn't get any usership. And that's what a lot of people and a lot of companies will do. The least expensive way to give the idea a fair shake and but minimize waste is to go out and talk to a dozen pet owners and ask them, what is the thing that you most wish was better or easier about owning a pet? And you're just never going to hear that, what, gosh, you know, I wish the dog was more fully employed. And you can, on that basis, you can reasonably say, okay, well, this is a need that nobody has. Nobody's got a latent desire to employ their pets. We can't observe that, anything like that behavior elsewhere. And on that basis, we could just say, hey, we looked at this idea and we're going to eliminate it. So I think the hard thing about doing things this way is mostly emotional. It's difficult to think about the possibility that your idea is not a success, because what gets us out of bed in the morning, particularly as entrepreneurs, is the excitement about the possibilities and all the interesting things we could do with our ideas. And that is important, and you do still have to have that. But the idea here is just to kind of condition it in a way where you ask, look, you know, this could be wrong, everything, because we could always be wrong. And how would we find that out with a minimum of waste? Because we can't oblige ourselves to be right all the time. Nobody ever is. And yet we do have, you know, it doesn't mean just go off and, you know, try things and see what happens. That's also kind of, that's less constructive than the alternative.
Okay. I like that. I am going to take a break. Before I do, though, I want to just ask you to ponder this. You know, how is your new book, Hypothesis Driven Development, how is that going to help companies with creative confidence around their teams and, you know, and more cohesiveness with the team? So, We'll answer that as soon as we get back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Well, welcome back, everybody. This is your host, Ken D. Foster. Before I get back to my guest, I want to remind you, if you haven't already and you're a regular viewer, go to our YouTube channel and subscribe to our feed there on YouTube. Why? Because now you can share it with your family and friends and entrepreneurs that you know or people that you care about so that they can grow their businesses and grow their lives. That's what it's about. So you can go to youtube.com. /@thecouragenetwork, youtube.com/@thecouragenetwork. We hope that you'll do that. All right. I'm speaking with Alan Cohen. He's got a new book out, Hypothesis-Driven Development. And let's talk about how does it build creative confidence and fluency across teams?
I really would say that the biggest thing I've learned about teaching in, you know, from an MBA program is that, at least at Darden, we use cases. And so rather than just being like, hey, these are all the things you should learn about accounting, we introduce those topics under particular sets of circumstances. And essentially, the book is about kind of teaching people this hypothesis-driven approach, but it's organized around the progression through a contemporary product pipeline. So how to, which is the whatever the processes are where we go from idea to release product that's out there in front of users. And that's the way that the book's kind of factored out. And so, for example, it looks at how do we take a hypothesis-driven approach to developing ideas about things users want? And then how do we take a hypothesis-driven approach to going from, you know, we think we should build out this proposition of letting people put their pets up online for jobs, or something more mundane, like we want to help our field technicians order parts by themselves from the field instead of calling the dispatch office. How do we build an app that enables and encourages that kind of self-service? The next chapter, we look at how do you go from design to code? And so, first we're just, how do we take an idea and make it testable? The second thing is, how do we take an idea and put it into a design that's testable so we can test usability? And which is sort of a necessary but not sufficient condition for something to be successful. And then we look at how do we use that to focus the way that we work with our development colleagues and actually build the thing, or maybe we're going to learn how to code and we'll build it ourselves. There's a whole industry in vibe coding now where people that are historically see themselves as non-technical can kind of learn fundamentals and then learn how to code. Following that, how do we take that process and apply it to the jobs of releasing and operating the software, which in practice is its own whole big domain and something you got to pay a lot of attention to as the general manager. And then the reverse is also true. If you don't, it'll come back and occupy your time and be a major drag on making time to do things well. And then the last chapter is we just look at running experiments. How do we a little more technique, if you will, about how we condition our evidence. And, do we need to put this in front of 10 customers or 100 customers to make a reasonable inference about it's working or it's not working?
Yeah, it seems like you could use the method also around marketing and also sales. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, I do think you can use it around sales. We do use it. I think that it loans itself to things that really high functioning sales managers will do, like learn about their domain and then have a really rigorous objective criteria for where an account is. Like, how do we qualify the account? How do we decide like it's dead? We can for now, but we can call them in 6 months when their budget rolls over, or establishing whatever ends up being important. How do we establish relevant but observable and actionable criteria for where an account is and how we decide to invest our time, our sales force's time? I think it absolutely loans itself to that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Well, let me ask you this then. How do you see business leaders, engineers, production managers, how do you see them implementing this with their teams, this book and the hypothesis?
Well, the long answer is, give them the book and, have them read it and try some of those things out. But the simple version where they can try it right away is just, you're going to talk to people about things that they think the company should do. And a simple way to try this approach out is just to ask, like, how do we test this with a minimum of waste? How can we get, sounds like a great idea, Charlotte. How can we see if this works? Like, how do we know if we go do this? How do we know if it's working versus it's not working?
Yeah. Yeah.
And in that doing that, you're putting Charlotte in the driver's seat. She can, you know, it's her idea. And now you're asking her to not just take ownership over going off and doing it, but kind of governing the consequences and what the next step is, instead of having, you know, you have to go back then and look at what happens and piece it together with everybody and make that decision under these kind of incomplete circumstances. So it is a way of giving more volition and to your teams. And it's a part of this broader movement where managers are trying to figure out how to get their teams to focus more on outcomes versus output and how to get themselves to enable their teams to do that. And it's that, I mean, that's a topic that I'll frequently, for example, go do talks or sessions about, or get questions on LinkedIn or wherever about how do we create this outcome orientation.
Right. That's good. Well, we're putting on the screen where they can get a hold of you, alexandercohen.com. For my listening audience, I'll spell it out. It's alexandercohen, alexandercohen.com. And they can get the book also, I believe, pretty much Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, you know, all those bookstores out there. We'll put the book up on the screen again. Hypothesis-driven development. And I believe that this is going to help a lot of businesses stay adaptable, stay innovative, and, you know, stay ahead of the curve, right? Whether it's your competition or you just need to reinvent, keep innovating so that your sales continue to grow and evolve. So, you know, as a professor at Darden School of Business, how do you see the future of product managing evolving, and what skills do you, tech leaders need to succeed in this changing landscape?
Well, the main thing is precedes the AI boom is that the kind of minimum efficient scale and scope for a team keeps getting smaller. You know, a very small team can accomplish big things because in digital, at least, because what they're doing is all automated. It's, you know, it's really just the execution of ideas. And that that existing trend was just sort of 10x by AI, and the fact that developers could be so much more productive, that people that are not traditionally trained as coders but have that disposition to get in and work on the product can now train themselves fairly readily to be pretty high functioning, not just with regard to getting things done, but to, you know, bringing that economic lens to making those decisions. So it's not going to make being a great developer any easier. That's going to be as hard as it ever was, or a great engineer, but it is going to help more people bring different perspectives to that work and not have to, you know, go bother an engineer for every little change or to try out every little idea or bring their ideas to life.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I'm so glad you wrote this book. I think it's going to benefit a whole bunch of people out there. And I appreciate you being here. Any final thoughts for our audience?
Just give it a try. Ask, how would we test that?
I love it. That's great. Well, Professor, thank you so much for being here. And the book is, well, I just lost it. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, the book is, I don't know where to go. Here it is, Hypothesis-Driven Development. And it is by Alex Cohen. And sounds like a fascinating book. Yeah, sounds great. Okay. So thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it. All righty. And I'd like to thank all of you for tuning in to Voices of Courage. And we appreciate you passing the show on, as I mentioned, to family and friends and people that would really benefit from this show. Again, you can go up to our YouTube channel and just you go to youtube.com/@thecouragenetwork and be sure to subscribe there, telling all your family and friends about this show. So from my heart to your heart, I encourage you to continue to see the unseeable and know the unknowable, and you will be able to do the impossible. Take care. Thank you.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.